Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The issue of abortion has been prominent in the legislature this year, and some are worried the attention to a service of reproductive health will hurt women's access to health care.
You're hesitant sometimes to draw too much attention to what you do because then you become the target.
We'll hear about the lack of affordable housing in Pinedale.
This has been a problem that has been occurring for the last couple of years for single moms or young professionals or newly married couples to find a place to move into that they could have as their first home.
And we'll talk to Governor Mark Gordon about a number of issues, including the legislative session.
I hope we get back to the Wyoming that I grew up in, which was much more, you know, live and let live. You know, I don't need to know what your business is, and I'm sure as heck not going to tell you what it is.
It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Anti-abortion bills have always come up in the Wyoming legislature, but recently a handful of measures requiring doctors who provide abortions to perform certain tasks have passed. Following the recent actions of other states, it was no surprise this year the Wyoming legislature considered something stronger, and it could potentially send two bills to the governor this year that would ban the use of abortion drugs or eventually the procedure altogether. Those who have lobbied against such legislation say elections that have put more conservative lawmakers on the floor is the reason.
I would guess 10 years ago, the Senate, the result would have been reversed on this bill. It's a gradual change that's happened.
That's Casper Senator Charles Scott, who's Wyoming's longest-serving legislator. Scott is speaking about the recent approval of a bill that would prevent doctors from using drugs for abortions. For many years, the House of Representatives would send abortion bills to the Senate, where they'd either get defeated or stymied. A lot of that was because of Scott, who's pro-choice and chaired the Senate Health and Labor Committee, where most of those bills were assigned. Scott is no longer chairman of that committee, and the legislature is more conservative.
I think what's happening is that the Right to Life forces have gradually gained political strength, and the pro-choice forces have lost it. They've been too reliant on the Supreme Court decisions and have not paid attention to advocacy at the grassroots. They've gradually lost support.
Despite what you might think, Wyoming actually has a history of being pro-choice. In 1994, for instance, 61% of Wyoming voters rejected the Human Life Protection Act that was designed to end abortions in the state. Scott doubts those numbers have changed dramatically.
No, it's been a change in who gets elected. Yeah, that's the way it works.
While the House has always had a good share of conservative members, the Senate was different. But after focused efforts by the state Republican Party, things have changed. Sabrina King is a lobbyist for the Wyoming ACLU and says it's very noticeable.
I mean, for me, I think the reality is that the culture war has come to the Wyoming Capitol for whatever reason, and it has come pretty hard over the course of the past couple of years, but I think this year more so than in other years.
Sarah Burlingame is a former legislator who heads up the organization Wyoming Equality. Wyoming frequently ranks near the bottom when it comes to women who hold elected office, especially in the legislature. She says that makes a big difference.
Like, when women aren't here and when we're not providing our voices and our perspectives to say, look, women in Wyoming make smart, healthy decisions about our health care when it's left between us, our partners, our doctors, our nurses.
Sharon Breitweiser is in charge of the organization Pro-Choice Wyoming. She agrees that getting the right people elected is important. Breitweiser says this year's legislation is troubling, but they have to stay focused.
We just have to keep fighting. We can't allow this climate to continue. We can't allow people to give up. You know, the pendulum will swing back.
And she means that. Breitweiser says as people get impacted by the policies on the ground, they will push back and change will occur. In the meantime, Sabrina King of the ACLU says the legislature won't keep abortions from actually happening. Many will continue to go out of state. And she says there are even ways for women to acquire abortion drugs. But King says the problem is they may not be taken under a doctor's care, which is concerning. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. As you just heard, this legislative session has a couple of bills focused on banning abortion in the state. The negative focus on abortion is causing confusion and in some cases leading to decreases of funding for preventive care, the type of care that could reduce the need for an abortion. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
There's chairs and pamphlets about birth control and STDs.
I'm standing with Michelle Gutierrez in the waiting room of the Northwest Healthcare Center in Cody. Gutierrez is the executive director of the Title 10 Clinic.
And this is the exam room. We really try. That was a thing that everyone loves when they come in, is that it's not hospital-y.
Title 10 is a federal program that provides money for family planning and reproductive health care to low-income individuals. They do this by providing basic preventive care at a sliding fee scale.
We provide annual exams, wellness exams, STD screenings. We provide birth control.
Things that are able to prevent pregnancies. Gutierrez says all the services they provide are essential and vital for the community. But it turns out, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control, in Wyoming, fewer women receive preventive care like breast exams annually than anywhere else in the country.
We've had a few who were diagnosed with breast cancer after coming here and seeing our provider first, and to just come in and tell us thank you for being here, because they probably wouldn't have went and got that lump checked because they couldn't afford it.
And here's the catch-22. Wyoming, like many other more conservative states, has gotten more aggressive in trying to ban abortion. Dr. Jovanina Anthony is an OBGYN in Jackson, whose practice is the only one in the state that provides chemical abortions. At the moment, there's no practice in the state that offers surgical abortions. Anthony says when she first moved to Jackson 17 years ago, she encountered a state that didn't want government involved in healthcare.
Over time, that has changed. Honestly, the last legislative session was really, really disheartening.
In 2021, legislators were very combative towards doctors that testified against anti-abortion bills. This current legislature is no different. Two bills are chugging along in this session. One would ban abortion if Roe v. Wade is overturned, and the other bans chemical abortion. The anti-abortion stance has even impacted basic preventive reproductive care by creating suspicion about what clinics provide.
There's a degree to which you want to make sure the services are still provided and protected, but at the same time, you're hesitant sometimes to draw too much attention to what you do, because then you become the target.
That's Rob Johnson. He's the executive director of the Title 10 clinics in Wyoming, like the one we visited in the beginning of this story. The program has had problems over the years, and mainly when politicians think that they are providing or encouraging abortions. This became a problem for a Title 10 Gillette clinic.
For years, they received money from the county commissioners and the city for services at that clinic. And then 2 years ago, those funds were cut.
Johnson says that's because of inaccurate information of what the clinic did. He says the cut came about when the clinic was asking for money to provide for annual well woman exams. Gail Wilson is clinical director at Wyoming's Title 10 clinics. She says it's frustrating when all they're trying to do is encourage women to get health care.
In Wyoming or any conservative state, access to reproductive health or asking for or needing reproductive health services is somewhat taboo, like mental health. And so people, it's something to be ashamed of. And it's another body system that needs to be taken care of.
This confusion over what is reproductive health care could get worse. That's according to Sharon Breitweiser, the executive director of Pro-Choice Wyoming. She says if the bill that would ban chemical abortions passes, it could cause more stigma and confusion for women just trying to get contraceptives or Plan B, which is more commonly known as the morning after pill.
There's this stigma that people don't know what's legal. People don't know what's abortion. There's all this conflation of emergency contraception with the early abortion pill when they're two very different things. People not knowing where they can go.
Michelle Gutierrez with the Title X Clinic in Cody agrees.
I think people are misinformed on what services we do provide. And I think that's where a majority of it stems from.
But she says no matter what, they're making a difference in many people's lives, whether that's giving a life-saving breast exam or contraceptives. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
When we come back, the latest on tribal jails and a look at labor statistics for Indigenous people. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. A report commissioned by the Interior Department outlines serious problems at tribal jails. It follows a Mountain West News Bureau, an NPR investigation, that found neglect and misconduct led to deaths at the jails. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vinson spoke with relatives and advocates about the findings.
For Laura Sue Pepian, the report detailing her brother Willie's death has only deepened her grief. Reading it, she thought,
this death wouldn't have occurred if they took the proper protocols. They had the proper training.
Willie Pepian was arrested for disorderly conduct in May 2020 after he was in a fight. A doctor cleared him for incarceration. He spent 13 hours in a cell at the Blackfeet Correctional Facility in Browning, Montana, and was found dead, having choked on his own vomit. Pepian was 22 years old. The report for the Interior Department says jail staff didn't have personal protection equipment, so they didn't take any measures to save Pepian.
There were so many people that seen him that night that could have saved his life, but they just didn't care.
According to the report, jail staffers also falsified records to indicate they had regularly monitored Pepian when they actually hadn't. His sister wants more information.
I'm just trying to understand, like, how a case like my brother's, which is listed as a homicide, is now federally closed.
She's also trying to understand why Darren Cruzan was hired by the Interior Department to review deaths of her brother and 15 others in tribal jails. Cruzan is the department's former top cop. His consulting company was awarded an $83,000 contract, even though some of the deaths happened on his watch.
It's like somebody being hired to put out the fire that they created with gasoline.
The Interior Department and the Cruzan Group have defended the contract award. An agency official said it didn't violate federal regulations. The report also says many jail staffers didn't know CPR and were often unprepared to handle medical problems. It recommended training for staffers. Brandy Tomhave is an attorney and member of the Choctaw Nation who focuses on health care in tribal jails. She says Native people are regularly denied proper care because the jails lack doctors or nurses.
There's just guards, and those guards are unfairly expected to medically monitor people, to make clinical decisions for which they are not in any way qualified.
That was the case with Richard Bennett. In 2018, he was arrested for possession of an open container and held at the Blackfeet Correctional Facility. The 28-year-old told guards he had chest pains, but his complaint was dismissed. Hours later, he collapsed. Two guards argued about whether he had a pulse. The report says that dispute delayed any life-saving measures for the next 7 minutes. 7 minutes that bring to mind one thing for Tom Rogers.
The 9-minute gap with regard to George Floyd.
The fellow Blackfeet member with the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders Council says those crucial minutes are eerily familiar. The lives of Floyd, who was Black, and Bennett, who was Native, were devalued by people in the criminal justice system. Neither is here today. Rogers says these conditions must change. Some lawmakers agree.
Our facilities and our resources in Indian country in terms of detention and corrections have to have a level of resource equity, and they don't have it now.
That's Congressman Raul Grijalva. He chairs the House committee that oversees the Interior Department.
The urgency of this equity question has been brought up before, and now it has more urgency, and we're going to exercise oversight.
Grijalva wouldn't go into details about what that oversight might entail, but the need for it isn't new. Problems in tribal jails have persisted for at least two decades. And for Laura Sue Pepian, the urgency comes too late.
Something like this being fixed, it would just numb the pain a little more than what it is right now.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs recently announced reforms to its jails. The changes include more training on how to perform in-custody death investigations, but they don't address larger issues like the need for better health care. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Robin Vincent.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the U.S. added around 500,000 jobs in January, but for the first time, they included monthly data on indigenous unemployment. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner reports that while this is a step in the right direction, there is still a lot of work to do to better understand unemployment for indigenous people.
Ryan Tyler is looking for a job. He's Northern Arapaho, and he's already employed, but with all the options available at the Fremont County Job Fair, he wants to keep his options open. I'm asking him what he wants in an ideal job, and surprisingly, he doesn't say anything about a starting wage.
My only kind of answer to that is just finding what's right for you instead of, you know, spending years, you know, like 10, 20 years in a job that you don't like, and you're making all these regrets, when you can just go out and find something else.
Tyler is one of the attendees at the Fremont County Job Fair at Central Wyoming College. The last time the job fair was held was right before the COVID-19 pandemic started in 2019. Attendance is low in comparison to pre-pandemic numbers. Event staff say there's a lot of organizations hiring, but not many people willing to sign on for just anything. Tyler likes his job at the local grocery store, but thinks it's good to keep looking for the best fit.
Finding something that you're going to really like, and finding a good work environment, and finding good people that you're going to work with, you know, people that are going to treat you good and people that are going to value you and your hard work.
Last month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics included Indigenous people in its breakdown of the labor market for the first time. These numbers report that while the unemployment rate was around 4.4% for January for the U.S. as a whole, the unemployment rate for Indigenous people is around 11.1%. That's more than double. Brookings Institute Robert Maxim, who's also Mashpee Wampanoag, says the difference is indicative of much more than anyone's work ethic.
And so I think that people need to continue to be really conscious about the fact that because of these, what I would say are government failures early in the pandemic to protect Native communities, that is going to affect how people choose to re-engage with the economy 2 years later, because they need to think about their health. You can't work if you're not alive, right?
Maxim says that even though this national data is a step in the right direction, the data are incomplete, partly because being multiracial isn't accurately represented.
The majority, almost two-thirds of Native people, identify as two or more races. So when you separate out two or more race data from people that identify as just Native American, just American Indian or Alaskan Native, you're effectively excluding three out of every five Native people in the U.S.
On the Wind River Reservation, the job market is slowly coming back to life. Businesses all over Central Wyoming are here at the fair, and around half of the booths at the job fair are from the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes. From tribal health positions, child care, and corrections positions with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Jamie Williams is the marketing manager at the Shoshone Rose Casino, and she's looking for applicants at the job fair. She says it's been a slow recovery since the Shoshone Rose closed for 400 days.
But it has been slow, and people, I think, were cautious at first. And I think depending on which side of the fence you're on with the pandemic, a lot of people were just afraid to kind of resume like events and parties and gathering, and we've kind of seen the effects of that too.
She says that it's a different job market now living with COVID-19 and that employers need to be flexible and ready to accommodate a new workforce.
I think today has been a good start to like rebuilding back the workforce and developing the workforce as well, because we're getting a lot of applicants that are, they don't have a lot of experience and they're younger, but they're at least looking to get into a job. And I think that that's very positive.
While the nation is starting to aggregate Indigenous unemployment, the state of Wyoming doesn't collect data on racial breakdowns. That makes it hard to account for the Indigenous workforce. Fremont County's unemployment rate, which much of the reservation is located, is around 2.5%. But because every other demographic is mixed into that number, it doesn't tell us much about the Indigenous workforce. The Wind River Tribal Employment Rights Office on the Wind River Reservation says that they don't have data on local unemployment rates for tribal members. Despite that, the office did say 385 people have signed up for their services to get help finding a job in the last year. But they serve anyone on the reservation, not just tribal members. Brookings Institute Robert Maxim says the state's lack of data shows that there's still a long way to go in getting good data on the Indigenous workforce in the U.S.
You know, I think there's as much a story there about the fact that there's no data as there is, like, here's what the data says. Because I think for Native people, the fact that there isn't enough data is itself a story.
Breaking down what is happening to the Indigenous workforce as we continue to live with COVID-19, we'll need more data. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Taylor Stagner in Riverton.
Coming up, we will look at housing concerns in Pinedale and a visit with Governor Mark Horton. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Much like the rest of the country, property in Sublette County has skyrocketed, making it hard for people to afford to live there. But some residents say they don't think prices will come back down. Data shows that the median cost of a home in Sublette County is about 25% more than the state as a whole. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, local leaders are exploring affordable housing options and looking to nearby Jackson to see what they're doing.
When Mitch Johnson first moved to Pinedale in 2019, the housing market looked a lot different.
It was pretty easy to find a place. It was very affordable.
He'd moved out to help sell his father's estate, which eventually went for about $300,000. But now, 3 years later...
As far as I know now, it was a large square footage home, and something like that now is almost doubled.
And that's true. The cost of housing has gone up. According to a report of the Wyoming Economic Analysis Division, the cost of a single-family home in the Pinedale area has gone up about 15% from 2020 to 2021. But that's not even the main problem, Johnson says. It's inventory, or the lack thereof. Johnson and his partner Sarah Munson have been looking for housing for themselves and four kids. Here's Munson.
I think if there was more availability, the prices might come down a little bit because people would be competing for that business.
And that's something Pinedale's Mayor Matt Murdock is aware of.
Pinedale has been in some ways discovered. We are a very beautiful community. We have made a lot of improvements within the community. I think there's been changes that have gone on through COVID or people just wanting to get out of cities.
In fact, over $30 million was spent collectively on real estate in the Pinedale area in 2021. According to town data, that's more than double from 2020. Murdock says that, paired with a population growth for the last 5 years, has created a shortage of affordable housing.
This has been a problem that has been occurring for the last couple of years for single moms or young professionals or newly married couples to find a place to move into that they could have as their first home.
So Murdock is looking into creating a dedicated affordable housing option in Pinedale, a first for the town. He's proposing home ownership by trust, a public-private partnership that develop 5 acres the town already owns into 56 housing units. People could buy the structures, but they wouldn't own the land, ideally preventing rising prices. The plan is loosely based on the Jackson Hole Community Housing Trust. It's a private, not-for-profit organization in neighboring Teton County. It's developed 181 homes since 1991. Here's Ann Creswell, the executive director.
We buy land. We then design, develop, entitle, and build homes that are affordable to our workforce in perpetuity. And then when we have a finished product, we sell to dedicated members of our community, and we enter into a 99-year lease agreement.
And that agreement is what keeps the housing affordable, Creswell says. They're limited to how much they can build in Jackson. It's a valley surrounded by a lot of public land. Creswell says that although it seems like Jackson's affordable housing dilemma is more extreme than Pinedale, she thinks in about 3 years, it could look pretty similar.
I would wager that this issue will creep up on essential employees of the town of Pinedale, your librarians, your teachers, all the people that maintain and take care of the essential infrastructure of your community, and healthcare providers.
Pinedale's affordable housing plan is in the early stages. Murdoch says he's creating a working group to flesh out the details. However, not everyone agrees with this approach. Chase Harbor is the owner and broker for High Mountain Real Estate in Pinedale. Harbor says affordable housing should come from a private enterprise, not the town.
I think it would be an issue that I would take personally if I'm out trying to maybe get investor money and go build some affordable housing, and then the town does it and competes with me and can do it cheaper.
For now, residents are making do. Mitch Johnson and Sarah Munson, from the beginning of the story, did find a rental. They jumped on it, sight unseen, but they had to downsize.
My two youngest will have to use the living room kind of as a bedroom because there's not enough bedrooms. But right now, it's just kind of logistics and having to settle, and just there's a roof over the kids' head.
Johnson and Munson are hoping to eventually purchase a home in Pinedale, if anything comes onto the market. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Pinedale.
Like everyone in Cheyenne, Governor Mark Gordon is busy keeping an eye on the Wyoming legislative session. However, the governor granted us some time to discuss the session and some other things he's focused on. I start off by asking about last week's amendment to cut gender studies at the University of Wyoming and the appropriateness of that.
Yeah, I think the budget is meant to be a budget, and it's supposed to be a single subject bill. I obviously can't promise anything one way or another, but I don't think it is particularly good form to start trying to legislate. What's in the budget or how the university should be doing its work. Part of why I have made the play I have for the Wyoming Innovation Partnership is really about trying to get the university a bit off the government dole, if you will, and a little bit more dependable sources of income that it has outside of that.
It would also seem to me that if they're trying to bring more people onto the campus and recruit people, seeing things like this happen could be troublesome to that mission.
Yeah, I think, for me, one of the big concerns that we have for the university, it's obviously had a fairly turbulent in the last few years. It needs time to settle and really to develop into the institution that can be a bellwether. You remember Raymond Plank, my former boss at Apache Corporation Oil Company I work for. Raymond always talked about universities ought to be a center of innovation and research and how important that is. And we really need our university to do that. If it's hamstrung by lots of different initiatives coming from the legislature, that sometimes complicates that.
You know, the computing degrees, upgrading on tourism, things like that. Have you been satisfied with some of the things you've seen come out of UW?
Yeah, nothing is is quite as perfect as you would hope it would be. But I'm really happy that we're taking the first steps towards that, particularly on tourism. You know, I think tourism is clearly the second leg of our stool, second contributor to our economy. It has a certain amount of non-correlation to oil, and so I think it's really good. So I've been very happy seeing the university stand that program up. The university's computing program is still in its beginnings, and I think it has a little ways to go. I do think that Wyoming has a tremendous potential with blockchain, what we're able to do with our speedy banks and DAOs and all of that, but we need to figure out how that's going to be valuable to the state.
Your whole goal is to try and get them to be a little bit more active in entrepreneurship and in creating jobs. And that's what you're talking about. It's been a little slow for you. Is that what I'm hearing?
it really has, Bob. I think my time as treasurer, where we had a number of companies come to us, which is fine, but you know, we had companies come to us and wanted the state to give money, and they might locate themselves here and hire some people and pay some taxes. That model, I think, hasn't worked that well in the past for the state. Not saying we wouldn't do it in the future, but what I think is really critical for the state's future is for us to build our entrepreneurial opportunities. You see companies like EMIT Technologies up in Sheridan. You see their ability to pivot in different economic times. You're seeing little businesses show up around the state, and I think the more of those small businesses we have, the better the ecosystem will be, and we'll start to see a lot of economy grow. Plus, those are jobs that if one little company fails, I hate to say that anybody would fail, but if one little company fails and it loses 5, 6, 7 people, that's pretty hard, but it's not 300 people from a call center that just can take down an entire town's economy.
Governor Mark Gordon visiting with us. One of the things you talked about in your State of the State message was young people, keeping young people here, what that's going to take. Some of this that we're talking about right now might be there, but I'm sure you've been doing some analysis, chatting with folks. What do you think what's the next step, big step we have to take as a state to maybe keep them here?
Well, I really think it comes down to education. I think the easy toehold into this is making sure that our K-12 system is solid and strong, best in the nation, because families are going to want to move here. All the sports and everything else we do in Wyoming that are associated with education clearly make this a great place for kids to grow up. Families are sticky. They like to stay in the communities they are. They're invested in their communities. They want their communities to be safe so their kids can go enjoy, what a town has to offer. So I think we really have to stay strong on our education. I think, and what I said was the paradox that we had was a lot of kids leave here because they don't see opportunity. And a lot of companies don't want to move here because they don't see workforce. So we've put a lot of money into workforce development, and that workforce has moved to Montana or Colorado or somewhere else. We need to kind of do both, and I think ARPA gives us that chance. The Wyoming Innovation Partnership that we did with the community colleges and the university is really built around helping to support entrepreneurs, helping to build workforce, and helping to attract new industries here, which presumably will be able to also give our kids the opportunity to say, hey, I might have a potential job here, and that'll work.
I also, oddly enough, at your business forum in November, I had an opportunity to talk with a lot of young entrepreneurs and young people. One of the concerns, though, that you hear is amenities. We've heard that for many years and trying to spruce that up. The other thing is attitudes in the state, and you've had a session where you've got a bill in on transgender athletes and a problem that doesn't seem to exist, but they're trying to address, and then you have critical race theory, different things that come up every year. Those things, can they be a setback?
You know, Bob, I think the important thing with education is that we start with parents and that parents have a chance to weigh in on what their kids' education is going to be and how that's going to affect their values. I do think that when somebody assesses Wyoming, there are a number of these issues that either can be attractive or kind of a pushback against people wanting to move here. The jury's a little bit out on that. But what I would say in my conversations with a lot of young people is, and I'm, you know, these are kids from high school right on up to their early 30s, 40s. They care a lot about what opportunity means. They care a lot about freedom to do what they care to do. They don't want to be heavily regulated. They would just as soon have a place that they can establish an enterprise, a business, and be able to build it without having to worry about government telling them everything they need to do. So I think both of those things weigh against each other. You know, the opportunity for an individual to start a company here, grow it, and see it flourish, and then maybe some of these more prescriptive things that are coming from the legislature. I hope we get back to the Wyoming that I grew up in, which was much more, you know, live and let live. Let's, you know, I don't need to know what your business is, and I'm sure as heck not going to tell you what it is. Just respect mine.
Healthcare. Medicaid expansion, tough go in the state of Wyoming. If we don't get something like that, what is the solution to getting more people back on health insurance who are starting to get priced out as they get better jobs and they're not able to get some of the subsidies that we've seen in the past?
Yeah, Bob, that's a good point. I think Wyoming does have some significant challenges here. I hate to just sort of run all the way to Medicaid because I think there are some obligations that we haven't fully understood yet that could be very expensive for future generations. But at the same time, you know, COVID has been sort of a mixed blessing in a way for the state because there were a tremendous amount of resources that came from the federal government that helped bolster our hospitals, helped bolster some of our institutions for medical care. At the same time, it put real demands on workforce, so that it just kind of shifted the challenges that we see. As we see COVID sort of ride off into the sunset, hopefully, and we see the kind of wind down and disentanglement from federal funding that we're at present going through, I think those you know blemishes that we saw in our healthcare are going to start showing up again. Are we going to be sustainable? Is it a long way to travel? I think about people in places like Worland, where you know, they obviously have pretty good care locally, but if they have anything significant, they've got to go to a place like Billings or Denver, and for the families, that's really hard. So this is a conversation Wyoming has just got to engage in, and in an honest way, about what is it we want to see.
And one of the challenges I imagine you have is the ability to get healthcare providers, because so many, as we've all reported on, have been burnt out.
Yeah, I think that is also true. It is remarkable, though, the resilience of our healthcare workers. And I think everybody can get a little bit tired at times. I hope as this press has come down and we've seen the spike come off and attitudes have softened a bit, and they realize that Wyoming did this much better than most places in the country, that if you're going to come to work in a place, it would be nice to work in a place like Wyoming. And hopefully that helps to mitigate some of the burnout and keep some of the people here. You know, there's some real price considerations, too. Places like Jackson, where, nurses live in homes that are now worth tremendously more than when they bought them, and wages are maybe better somewhere else. And I think this is another thing that our hospital districts are going to have to come to terms with.
You're doing an outstanding job setting up my next topic and question, but let's talk a little bit about housing. You mentioned Jackson, where it's just crazy, but, you know, honestly, when you go across the state,
Sheridan, Laramie, Cheyenne, you know, no matter where you go, you're the Star Valley area, you're seeing tremendous housing prices. As you look at the situation and you talk to people, is there really anything you can do, or is there something we can do as a state to try to make sure that people can get affordable housing?
Yeah, that is, if you're talking about inhibitors to business development in Wyoming, that's certainly one of the biggest ones, and we've identified it. We pushed hard to get Wyoming Community Development Authority, WCDA, which has done a lot of low-income housing, but kind of in a modest fashion along the way. We've really tried to amp it up and ramp it up, too. One of the things, Bob, that I've really tried to stress in my administration is if we have the Business Council doing workforce housing and we have WCDA doing workforce housing and we've got some other agency coming in, rural development or something else, let's at least coordinate this so that we can move the needle in a big fashion. That's in its initial stages. I'm really happy that the first tranche of some of that housing money is going out to Jackson. That's certainly needed. But it's not just low-income affordable housing. It's also sort of middle housing. And that, for Sheridan, talking to Adam Weatherby, that was one of the biggest challenges he had, was for his management staff to come in and find a house that they could afford that they thought was reasonable. So this whole range of housing is something that we've really put a lot of stock in. And yeah, I think we can move the needle. We have some of the resources to be able to do that now.
We are just about out of time. I wanted to ask you, though, about one last little thing. And we're starting to see some environmental groups being successful on some topics, and one of those you thought was probably settled, and it involves wolves. I saw the latest lawsuit proposed for that. Any concern that we're going to lose our ability to manage wolves and some of the wildlife we currently manage?
Bob, I think there's always a concern that we could lose some of that. Wyoming is going to stand up and stand strong to make sure that we can retain control over our wildlife species. I will say, and you've known me for a while, and you know how strong I have advocated for these issues, and I have continued to push with this administration. Wyoming has done it right. We don't have a problem with wolves. We have a management plan that is effective and is working. We do know how to manage our grizzly bears. That is something that you need to turn over to the states. We're the state that managed to rescue the black-footed ferret. We've done the most credible job on sage grouse. Wyoming really does have it right. There are some states, obviously Montana and Idaho, that have kind of raised a few flags at this point. We've been really particular in talking to this administration about don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. If you've got issues with those states, take it up with those states. Don't throw Wyoming into that mix.
Governor Mark Gordon, a pleasure. Enjoy it when you get an opportunity to look at the bills here in a few days, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob, and thanks to everyone listening.
When we come back, we will discuss the 150th anniversary of Yellowstone National Park from a slightly different perspective. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Yellowstone National Park turned 150 years old this week. Park officials say they are taking this anniversary to work toward including more tribal perspectives and involvement within the park. Robin Rothkar with the Eastern Shoshone Cultural Center in Fort Washakie tells Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner about her many trips to the park over the years and what she would like to see change to support more Indigenous visitation.
I feel very fortunate that my family has always visited Yellowstone. My grandpa is actually from the Flathead Reservation, and I have pictures where my mom was a teenager and they drove through the park on their way up to visit his family. And she always loved going to the park and drug us kids along, and so I do the same with my kids and grandkids too. And there's a place called Sheep Eater Cliff that we saw on the map, and it was kind of out of the way of our usual loop that we do, but I said, we got to go there and check it out and see what the sheep eaters did at this place. So we went up there and it was a big disappointment. The area you pull off, there's potholes. You pull into the parking lot, all you see is about 30 trash cans, recycling bins. And then there's a little sign where it says, oh yeah, this interesting looking cliff was named after the sheep eaters who lived in Yellowstone Park over the years, part a branch of the Shoshones. And that's all it said, and I was really disappointed. But I'm glad that now Yellowstone Park is reaching out to Native people for the 150th anniversary. They're trying to get the Native voice in and get, they're open to suggestions now. So I'm hoping they can build that up, because what is a big disappointment there could be a great opportunity for Yellowstone to expand it, to bring in Native peoples for talks, demonstrations, even just have more information up. I think there's only a couple other places in the park where they mention Natives. Once we stopped at a roadside display close to West Yellowstone, and it talked about Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce tribe and his band when they were running away from the army and came through Yellowstone Park on the way trying to get up to Canada. And that was interesting. And I think there's one feature called the Dragon's Mouth, and it's a little fumarole steam vent kind of thing. And there's a sign there that talks about the Kiowa creation story is actually based there. Other than that, throughout the whole of Yellowstone Park, there's very little mention of Natives, nothing really that I've seen, and I've been there 50 times. I think it's very sad, because a lot of our community members here have never been to Yellowstone, or maybe been once and are kind of not feeling welcomed up there. I know about 20 years ago when we heard, oh, you can get in for free with your tribal ID. And we tried that and we'd get these questions. And if we said the wrong thing, oh, you got to get special permission from the park superintendent. And sometimes we just give up and say, okay, well, we'll just pay so we can get on our way. So now if you just show your tribal ID, they don't question you at all. They'll just ask you if you want the brochures and maps and send you on your way. And you can just feel the power of the place too when you're out. Of course, being in the mountains and the woods is always special, but Yellowstone, just you can feel that power. Of course, there's all that power rumbling that you can't help but pick up, but it feels like a very spiritual and powerful place. And I'm sure over the millennia, all the Natives that visited there felt the same way. You know, they're figuring the sheep eaters were the only tribes that actually lived there year-round, but there's ties to 29 other tribes that you know, probably visited the area. They apparently found some big earthen camas ovens where these camas roots that were important part of the Shoshone's diet back in the day are inedible unless you roast them for 3 days. So they found these big camas ovens, they call them, and not to mention all the other resources that are up there, from pine nuts to bitterroot, sago lilies, biscuit root, all the berries and the different animal resources too that the tribes used to live off.
There's so much like history and culinary knowledge there that if there's no signage, if there's all these millions of people every year can just drive by and they wouldn't even know. Like, why at the 150th are park officials like kind of reflecting and being like, all right, well, maybe we should be more critical of the creation of this park? Like, why do you think now?
Well, I think Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland has a lot to do with this, which is awesome. And I think, yeah, so that now they're looking at the history. During the previous administration, when national park budgets were getting slashed, there was a push of, wow, why don't we put them back in the hands of the Native people to manage these places? And it's still, that idea is still floating around out there, which would be awesome. Then we would get a real, you know, can incorporate the real perspective of, yeah, what this land meant to the people, what it still means. how they could make it better, because we want people to see not only the history of the natives, but we're still here, we're still trying our best to survive and flourish, and the native culture has kind of been scrubbed from the park.
Is there any other aspects about the anniversary that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I just hope that more people from the tribes here go up, more people from Wyoming go up. Yeah, the crowds and the traffic might be crazy, but it's so beautiful. But it's really something that I think everybody in the area should experience, especially all the native people. It's go see where, the ancestors used to live. There's a lot of history there, a lot of spiritual feeling. You can feel the power of Mother Earth there.
Thank you, Robin. This is Robin with the Eastern Shoshone Cultural Center. Thank you very much, Robin, for talking with me.
Oh, thanks for coming. Hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and individual segments can be found at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Also find our podcast at all the usual places. Ivy Engel is our digital producer this week. Stories from this show and from throughout the week can be found on our station Facebook page and on Twitter. And a goodbye to our longtime digital producer, Anna Rader, who's moved on to greener pastures. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.